Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's literally impossible to make a game. I don't know if people talk about that enough.
Making games suck. From everything I've heard. Bad. But also quite beautiful. But also...
Yeah, oh. In its own way. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Ruby Innes, and welcome to Pocket Buds, a back pocket podcast where I talk to my best buds about video games and stuff. Today, we're talking about Mystiques. Picture this. You're an antiquer in the home of a recently deceased individual. You're perusing through the many, many vases that sit covered in dust on the shelves. They all look to have been owned by someone's nan. You're not too sure how much these vases are worth, but you know that their value can rely on their condition, so it's important to give them a thorough look. As you check each one out, you seem to hear a soft voice in the back of your mind.
Careful with that. I got that one from Vinny's for $5. It was a steal. Have you washed your hands?
Uh-oh. All the vases are haunted by a doting old lady. Does this make them more or less valuable? That's for you to find out in Mystiques. Mystiques is a whimsical, haunted, antiquing adventure game being developed by Lemonade Games, a new studio based in Sydney. In it, you are tasked with inspecting all sorts of antiques to sell for a worthy price, and the antiques in question may or may not be housing some spooky ghosts. That's for you to find out. The game is in pre-alpha, and Lemonade Games has made it their mission to be as transparent about the development process as possible, so that those following the game can get a look into exactly what it's like for a small team to make a funky little game. Joining me today to talk about her history in the games industry, her thoughts on the local industry, her passion for insufferable women, and of course Mystiques, is game director at Lemonade Games, Ali McLean Hennessy. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Of course, I am joined by the lovely Ali McLean, who you may know as a video game lady. You may know as my close personal friend. You may know as a cosplayer. You may know as a woman online and a myriad of other things. How would you define yourself?
I didn't come on here to be insulted. Oh, look, all of the above accurate. I don't do cosplay anymore, but I do still make video games, yeah. And I am still known to be online.
It's true. I've seen it. Someone who also goes online.
You can't prove it.
I've seen you there. I have receipts. When did you stop cosplaying?
God, I don't know. Probably like 6 years ago, something like that. It was around the time that I was working on sort of my first big game project that I was really heavily involved in. And I think development just like takes over your whole life. And also, like, realistically, much as I loved doing cosplay, like, for me it was a path into getting into games. And so I got into games and mission accomplished.
Well, that's the funny thing is just there's so many different paths into games, right? Like, I would argue I tripped and fell over. And when I fell over, I had blood all over my knees and I looked down under my hands and I was in the video game
industry.
What we
can agree upon is that no one would ever do it on purpose.
It is always on accident, constantly. I came from radio and like to come.
Which is objectively much cooler.
It is.
Sort of
I have so many regrets. I think about it a lot. I'm like, oh, maybe I should just go back to community radio. But like, no, it's not paid.
This is the podcast where I convince you to quit.
Yeah. So this is the it's going to be the title, the episode where Ruby quits video games.
I did dedicate several years of my life to convincing women to get into the games industry, and now I'm sort of pivoting.
Yeah, you're like, get out of it.
Get out of here.
It's not good. Get out. You're like the co-owner of Koei Tecmo. God, her name leaves me, but she's the co-founder of Koei Tecmo. She co-founded it with her husband, and she had a studio called Ruby. I think Ruby Games or something like that.
This sounds like a web of lies that you're making.
No. It was in my International Women's Day article in Kotaku. Cute. She had a studio within Koei Tecmo that pretty much developed the first dating sim.
Oh, cool.
And they, the way that she, the big part of it is the entire studio was women.
Nice.
And she basically just picked and chose women from like different industries, all kind of like tech stuff, pick and chose them. And then we're like, I'm going to teach you how to work in game development. And you're going to work in my studio.
Yeah, that's sick. I think like cross-functional career paths, like not even like into games with a goal of like staying in games, but even just studios that work with other creative industries on a game project. I find like those are some of the most refreshing games that I've played recently. Like Gubbins is amazing. And Gubbins, they work really closely with, Jackie Winter, the design agency, who are, you know, obviously not game specialists, but you can tell when you play that game that it comes from like a really refined design and aesthetic sensibility. Yeah. I think you just feel it so much in the experience.
I would say the same about Ember Lab.
Yes.
Oh my God, my brain is just not working today. I loved that game.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name as well.
You know what I'm talking
about?
Kena Bridge of Spirits.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Yes, and they're in animation studio.
Yeah, they're in animations. They did that incredible Majora's Mask animation that everybody knew them for.
Yeah.
And then one thing led to another, and they're like, oh, we're making a game. Kena Bridge of Spirits came out. People were not kind to that game, despite it being an animation studio's very first video game.
And I played it, I think, like launch week, and it was incredibly refined for a studio's first game.
Polish.
I do think that like animation as a discipline is incredibly underserved in the games industry. I think it's often thought of, and I've been guilty of this myself as like a producer and as a director, you think of animation as like a layer on top of the game, but it informs so much about the player experience, is like even just the sense of you can fake so much that isn't there in the code and isn't there in the design with just like the little touches that an animation can inform the player feedback. It can just inform your connection to the character. It can really smooth out rough edges in a game as well.
Yeah.
And often like animation as a discipline is not treated with the same respect and like resourcing and like level of importance and like inclusion in like design conversations and like kickoffs for meetings, that kind of thing.
Well, that's the funny thing is like, I mean, the video game industry in Australia is not well funded, It's getting better, but it's not realistically, and it needs to get better. But if we're talking about creative industries that are underfunded, the animation industry, yeah. You got Bluey, and that's it.
Yeah,
Bluey got so much, and great for them. Bluey rocks. I'm very pro Bluey, but the animation industry in Australia is very limited for a reason, and it's because there's just not a lot of funding. Mm-hmm. I know a studio, Chalk Chip Animation. I'm pretty sure they're in Melbourne, and these two girls doing their shit, making this little animated web series. It's fantastic, and I saw some comments like, "Oh, when is this coming out?" Like, "Oh, it's been ages." It's like, yeah, there's two of them.
Yeah.
And they're not getting funding from the government or anything. Australia isn't supporting them. They should. They're just doing their own thing. Give them a minute. Huh? Yeah. Give them a minute.
That's the difficulty, I think, of sharing anything that you're working on early is people are so trained now to like see the first thing and then like get the instant gratification of like, and now you'll give me the entire product.
It's coming out.
Yeah. Now. And it's streaming and you can watch it right now. Like, but when you're an independent team, you're always sort of weighing up between, do we share something early and like start building like a grassroots following for this thing and like bring people along for the journey, knowing that they're probably going to be disappointed with how long it takes to make the thing, or do we wait and then only share it when it's sort of like too late to adjust anything to feedback or to like have enough time to build a community if you don't have like a massive marketing budget to do that overnight or like a giant IP to like leverage an audience from. So it's really hard.
Well, on that note, actually, your game that you're working on, Mystiques, from my research, I know that your team has kind of made it, I guess, part of your mission to be very, very transparent with the development process. What kind of sparked that decision?
Yeah, look, I think so. Inga, Adam, and I were the co-founders of Studio Lemonade, and all of us have worked in the game industry for a reasonable amount of time now. We've all had a lot of experience working on games that took a really long time. We weren't allowed to talk about, under NDA, or took a really long time and then got cancelled, and we never got to tell anyone about it. You know, and so for us, like, we want the experience of everything that we make at Lemonade to be really joyful and to be about genuine connection between people. We think that like it's not just about, I mean, obviously it's massively about the game that you make at the end of the day, but it's also about the process of making the thing. You spend most of your life making stuff, and so you have to make the experience of making the thing as enjoyable as possible. And part of that for us is being able to share stuff, even if it's like this thing might not end up in the game or it's going to change massively before the game comes out. Just being able to share the joy of like creation is a really important part of making games for us.
Absolutely. And what would you say has been your favorite part of the creation of Mystiques so far? Because, you know, it's still so early days, so a new favorite thing might pop up tomorrow, you know. But what's been your favorite part so far?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things. I think, like, for me, the games industry is not an easy place to work. And I've been really lucky in my career so far, but I've also struggled a lot, you know, working in companies that sort of had very different values to me, or sort of dealing with just being a woman, like navigating
a classic
conundrum. I mean, it's like, it's tough to be
the burden
a lady
of being abroad.
I was gonna expand upon it, but I feel like I don't need
no
to, you know
you
what
really
I mean
don't but like by all means if you'd like to
let's get in, this will be a 3-hour podcast. And I also like I was so fortunate to make this game Rumu, which was very early in my career, and I worked with Adam, who's one of the co-founders of Lemonade, on Rumu, and we got really lucky in that like we were working on that game within a company that weren't really used to making games and also had a lot of other stuff going on, and so they weren't really paying a lot of attention to us. And
awesome.
So it meant that we got to have this very organic discovery of the game making process together, and we got to tell a story that we really cared about, and we got to really put our whole heart and soul into it. It's very rare that you get to do that ever in your entire career, and so we got really lucky to do that really early. It also means that we were very spoiled, because we had that experience. It was not a sustainable experience. We couldn't keep doing that forever.
Yeah.
And so we then had to go off and work in other companies. And I'm really grateful, obviously, blah, 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 PR stuff for all the other companies. Being employed is good.
I love all of my past employers.
I love all bosses.
They're my best friends.
I love paychecks.
Love money, love making it, getting paid, awesome.
But I have, you know, had to go on and work on games that were not my games, like were not the thing that I was most passionate about making. And so I think the most joyful part about Mystiques is that it is like completely us as artists. It is who we are, and it's a true expression of, you know, the kind of thing that we want to put out into the world. And there's just so, like, we all went away at the end of last year. We all, the whole team went away. We rented an Airbnb in the Blue Mountains, and it was in between two antique stores. The game is about antiquing, by the way. We just spent a few days just like game jamming, just like thinking about not just what game we're making, but like why are we making this game and why is it special to us and why is this a story that we want to tell? And it's such an incredible privilege to get to have an experience like that and share it with people that you really care about and that you vibe with creatively. And I mean, if the game never comes out, I just have loved making it so far.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I mean, the concept of haunted antiquing, where did that come from?
Yeah, so my friend Sean, who's working on the game, we were working together at a studio, a big studio, working on like lots of sort of work for hire projects. And Sean and I used to have coffee together every morning, and we would just talk about our lives and everything and share stories. And one day he told me the story about how he used to work for an antiques dealer, and his job was like going to dead people's houses and like going through all their stuff. And I was like, bro, that sounds like a game. And obviously it's me, so therefore I had to add some kind of like spooky element to it.
Of course.
When I think back of like every game I've ever pitched for myself, it's always in some way about dead people's houses.
So what if you were in a house?
Like, so spoilers if you haven't finished playing Rumu, but you come out a long time ago, but those bitches are dead.
Soz.
But yeah, I mean, I also think like I think there's a big like antiquing community online, lots of different like subsets of those communities as well. And there's obviously a very strong crossover with people who are interested in like spooky stuff.
Yeah.
So we think there's a good audience for that.
Absolutely. And how have you kind of, cause like, I mean, I think I own some kind of antiques, so really vintage stuff. Right. But the act, I would argue that the act of antiquing could be seen as a very kind of elderly sport. So how are you guys kind of addressing adding, you know, twists and turns to the antiquing experience?
Yeah, I think so much of it is about discovery. I think the joy of discovery. So if you have ever spent some time rummaging through an antique store, you know that the moment of glee when you find something special doesn't necessarily mean that it's valuable, but just something that speaks to you, like a weird little fucked up statue of a frog or something is usually what happens to
you
me.
You mean a cool little fucked up statue of a frog?
And so I think that translates across all demographics, you know, the joy of discovery. I'm also a really big fan of like detective style gameplay.
Yeah.
And I find that there's, essentially, Mystiques is a detective game, even though it is about antiquing and shop management. Like mechanically, it's very much a detective game. You're exploring these spaces, you're sort of uncovering clues, and it's like gentle layering of like inspection puzzles, which is very much like detective and deduction gameplay, which I think appeals to a lot of people outside of people who are purely interested in antiques.
Yeah. What would you say is the best antique find you've found in an antique store?
I recently found, I've been really interested. There's this podcast called Antiques Freaks, which is a great show. Anyone awesome. Would like to listen to it. And they did a whole episode about blow molds, which are these like old fashioned, I'm going to explain this so badly, old fashioned decorative items, like the original like lawn flamingo is sort of like one of the most popular blow molds, but there's a lot of them are for like seasonal ones, so like Halloween, like vintage Halloween blow molds are really cool. Mm. And I did find one that was just like a little ghost that hangs out in your backyard. And he's just so cute. So that's my number one. I mean, interesting that it's a ghost.
Interesting.
I'm reflecting on my choices. We're all learning things today.
Seems like everything connects somehow. I found that there's an antiques shop near my house, my new house, and it had these beautiful glasses, like a pack of five glasses, they're all different colors, and they all had like these like very, very old school floral designs on them.
Mm.
Very, very fragile, thin glass. I am the world's clumsiest woman in the sense that I think I should win an award for it. And I think I should break that award on accident. And I, during our move, I was pulling something out from a shelf. And in front of that thing that I was pulling out were those glasses. All stacked on top of each other. I don't know why I didn't see them. I think my brain just sort of blocked them out for a second. As I pulled that out, all of them fell to the floor.
Oh, no. Crashed. God.
And I was like, oh.
And when it gets worse when you think about how old it is and how many people took care of it and how long it lived.
and how quickly it died.
I have an obsession with lobster plates, which is something was big in like the 60s and 70s. And I have six of them.
Oh, my God. Oh, that roasts.
I recently got one for a wedding present. That's how much people know that I'm obsessed with them. And that's probably my prized possession now I think about it. It's like a little a dish that's like a big lettuce leaf or a cabbage leaf.
Yeah.
And it's got three little tiny red, like hyper-realistic sculpted red lobsters holding up. They're like presenting the dish to you.
That rocks.
This is something so fucked up about it. Like, these lobsters are some kind of servant.
They're like, here you go, master. That rocks so hard. And we spoke about your history of cosplay. And you know, you're also wearing a very fashionable dress right now. So I would say that, you know, you have a history of turning looks, right? And
I live to serve.
You live to serve. Your Honor, she's slaying, I fear. But the characters in Mystiques also, I fear, are slaying.
That's
and I
so
fear
true.
Because it's haunted. And I get scared. Would you say that your unequivocal slays have kind of had like an influence on the designs of the characters? I'd actually really like to talk about the character designs.
I feel like I've been waiting for this question my whole life.
Good.
So, yeah. Genuinely, the fashion in Mystiques was really important to me. It was a big part of the initial conceptualization of the game. When I talk about the game to people, I tell them it's about four insufferable women who run a failing antique store, and their fashion, you know, obviously like in all character design, the clothes that they're wearing is reflective of their personality, whatever.
Mm.
But for me, it's important that they look completely insane.
Yeah.
I think that I'll give you a little plug for a talk that I'm going to do in October. I don't know if this podcast is going to come out before then, but I'm doing a talk at Free Play Parallels, and it awesome. Is called In Defense of Insufferable Women. I think that fashion systems historically in games have been really undervalued and under-resourced. I think often we think about fashion just as like customization and cosmetic, whereas to me fashion is about self-expression, and it's also about... It's reflective of how we evolve as people, how we dress and how we choose to express ourselves and how we present ourselves to the world. And that's true of, I think, everybody, regardless of whether you have an interest in like fashion as an industry and fashion as an art form, the way that you choose to clothe yourself and present yourself to the world, it means something. It means something to you. And so in our game, fashion doesn't just exist as something that's beautiful and fun to play with, which is like, that's enough. That's great.
That's good.
But it also exists as a way to unlock additional experiences within the game. So if you are the kind of player who's particularly interested in learning more about sort of the inner life of our characters and the way that they interact with each other and the things that they're interested in, then if you choose to pursue collecting fashion items and equipping fashion items, you will actually get to experience more about the inner life of our characters and the way they interact with each other. Because, I mean, like, what is going to be more of a conversation starter than walking into a room wearing the most obnoxious coat that you could possibly find?
Ask me where I bought this.
People are going to want to know things about and your life.
What if you were four of the worst bitches you've ever met?
That's right.
But you also look fucking incredible.
That's great. I mean, that's the game I want to play. I genuinely want more games about women who just suck.
I think there is a genuine fear in the games industry of, because you know what? I love when girls in games. Me love when women in games.
So true.
Me love when women be in game, exist in game, in all forms. So like when they're slaying, rock. And when they're good, awesome. When they're the hero, amazing. But I feel like there's a fear of making a woman suck.
Yeah.
Making a woman who's a dickhead.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I suck.
Yeah, I say some shit. Like, if I were in a game, I would want to be represented right.
Right.
Saying some dog shit. Right. You know?
Yeah, I'm an idiot. And and I have no shame about that. And so, like, for me, representation for idiots.
Absolutely.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Like, it's okay for a woman in a game to be fucking dumb.
Or is it just
so
be a
stupid
bitch? Like, it's totally
or just a
fine.
Bitch, yeah.
Like, it's totally fine to be psycho about stuff. Like,
oh, yeah.
We're all psycho about stuff. And for me, like, so in our game, our main character, Jem, she is kind of in her early 20s and she's going through that stage in her life where she has these really big dreams, but the sort of confines of her world are really collapsing in around her. And I'm going to go down a path here.
Go ahead, please. Please go down.
I don't know if you know
path.
What a tulpa is.
A tulpa. No, I've heard of that.
It's a thing that, like, David Lynch is obsessed with, if that gives you any kind of window.
Awesome.
But it's basically, also, if you ever go on, like, r/tulpas on Reddit, God, it's so interesting.
For the unknowns in the crowd, yeah. What is a tulpa?
So, it's another question I've been just dying for someone to ask me.
Yeah, I've been told I'm the best interviewer.
That's so true.
I know all the secret questions.
So a tulpa is it's like a thought form. So it's like Santa Claus, for example,
right.
Something that we make real by believing that it's real, by thinking about it. So it's the idea that, like, human beings can sort of will something into existence.
Mm.
And so for Jem, who's our main character, she develops psychic powers after having a particularly bad day. And suddenly these psychic powers, like, unlock a totally different perspective on the world, different perspective on the people around her and on herself and her power and, like, what she can do in the world. She is not a particularly, she doesn't use those powers in a particularly noble fashion. Like, she starts to sort of let her, like, capitalist urges take over, and she sort of uses them in a way that is more about if I can, you know, unlock the history of this beautiful lamp and the person who owned it and their relationship with their family and, like, the fact that they left it behind for their child and their child never received it, you know, Gem is always going to make the choice to then be like, okay, well, how much can I sell that for?
Seems it's got mystic value and also monetary value.
Basically could be a line in the game. Yeah. So,
well, hey, if you need a writer, I know the secret questions.
So we sort of bring like tulpa theory into the game in that way, where it's like there is always a question of, are these visions and these psychic experiences that Gem is having, are they real or are they her sort of deciding that she is an all-powerful being and then like using that confidence to sort of brute force her way through the world and through life. I love a story about a psycho woman deciding to succeed.
Absolutely. And like, she sounds very fascinating. I'd also love to hear about the other characters you've got in store, if possible.
Yeah, I can tell you a bit about Aspen, who is Jem's best friend in the game. She's got the green fuzzy coat. She's everyone's fave when they've played our demo so far. So Aspen is just the most aggressive person. Aspen is sort of responsible for a lot of the like day-to-day functioning of the store. And so she's very commercially minded. Also, Aspen is the kind of person that she has a really special relationship with Gem, but she would never admit it. She would never call her best friend, but she is sort of quietly devastated at the idea of Gem ever leaving and ever getting out of the town that they live in.
That's like me and Gus. I always call Gus my best friend, and I always egg him on to say it back. It's the same.
It's exactly the same. Yeah. So Aspen, you know, she's always tagging along. She comes with you on your antiquing missions. She keeps you on track with the stuff that you need to get done in the store, but she also is sort of making sure that Gem doesn't get too big for her boots because she doesn't want her to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's another like aspect of like the, you know, bad girl.
Yeah.
The insufferable
kind of a toxic
woman.
Friend.
Yeah, yeah. Bad friend.
It's like she's great and she's super fun to hang out with, but like maybe you shouldn't consult her on your life choices.
If you want to move, don't tell her. Yeah. She might sabotage that.
Also, do not ever complain to her about your boss because she will kill them.
They're dead. Yeah. And you might have blood
on your
hands.
She will find their address.
It's not your fault, but it actually might be, unfortunately. So how would you compare your experience with developing mistakes compared to your other experiences in the industry? I know we talked a little bit about it at the start, but would love to expand on it a bit.
I think a lot of the places that I've worked, you know, again, I love all my employers, but I...
work rocks.
Work is so good. I think that, you know, I grew up with a real appreciation for like Barbie games and like The Sims and all of these sort of big IPs that like are now very iconic, like particularly Barbie's like really having a moment. Mm. And I hope that leads to a resurgence in like slightly more interesting Barbie games and stuff coming back. Like I would love a detective Barbie game again.
Well, Bratz Flaunt Your Fashion came out last year and I reviewed that positively.
Yeah, I saw your review.
I thought
review.
It was so much fun. Yeah. And it wasn't trying to be any more than mm-hmm. your classic licensed game. And yet I still think it did really well in that aspect. You dress up your Bratz. Fucking rocks, and you could choose which one you were, and I always chose Jade because she's so me. But like there is the capacity for licensed games to be good, and I think there are plenty of developers who want to make them good and not mm-hmm. just kind of like a quick cash grab. And I feel like with the Barbie movie being so successful, maybe there could be that resurgence, because so many Barbie games were just on browser, they were mm-hmm. just web games. Hopefully the video game industry sees that and goes, maybe we should invest in Barbie again. People would play Barbie games.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, ultimately, it's up to Mattel, like, where they choose to give that license to. And certainly they've done a lot of, like, mobile stuff recently, which, you know, fine.
Mobile is – I've grown to appreciate mobile games that are made with love.
Oh, and there are so many great ones as well, like Mini Metro, for example.
Mini Metro, stands Gubbins. Out to me.
Yeah, Gubbins. Gubbins playing... slaps. It goes so hard. Everyone should be playing Gubbins.
Everyone should play Gubbins. I've been playing Hello Kitty Island Adventure.
Oh, is that good?
Fantastic licensed game. Arguably one of the best licensed games I've ever played.
Trailers for that, and I was like, this sort of looks like it was made for me personally.
It rocks. It rocks so hard. And the Sunblink team, they're from Colorado. They rock. They are like diehard Hello Kitty fans. The 1.1 update to this game, they were like, we listened to your feedback. You can now craft multiple things. And it is one of the, it's a hard thing of like, you can't answer everybody's questions.
Yeah.
You can't solve everybody's problems in a game. Over time, you can probably fix every bug, but then sometimes a new bug will come up.
Every time you fix a bug, there's a new bug.
Exactly. Yeah. That fix became a problem, and it rocks.
It's literally impossible to make a game. I don't know if people talk about that enough.
Making games suck. From everything I've heard, bad, but also quite beautiful. But also,
In its own way. Yeah. And that's kind of, I think, what I was getting at is that I have worked on... you know, small indie games. I've worked on AAA games, cancelled AAA games, licensed games, original IP, and a lot of them for other people. And for me, much as like, I would have told you probably 5 years ago, like working on like a Barbie game would have been a dream come true for me. And at one of my jobs, I was definitely like exposed to the development of a licensed project with Mattel. Mm. And by all accounts, they seem very nice to work with. But I think being exposed to all these different forms of game making and all these different types of intellectual property, what I have learned from that is that I'm not going to experience the like transformation of self as an artist that I am looking for in making games by working on other people's IP and working on other people's games. That's not to say that I don't enjoy it, and there's lots of parts of it that are an incredible privilege to get to do as a job. Like, it's a very silly job.
Oh, yeah.
And I absolutely love it. But for me, as an artist, like, the part of me that just wants to fully express myself in the way that I see the world, I think that making games like Mystiques is what I need to do. Like, it is in my soul that I need to do this. And so that's how it's different. That's how making Mystiques is different to the other things that I've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I mean, it is such a different experience to make something that is yours, right?
Yeah.
And you know, Mystiques Studio Lemonade, you're all Sydney based?
Except for Sean, who's down in Melbourne.
And how have you found kind of making this new studio and working on this game in Australia? With what we've got.
And in New South Wales, it's hard.
In New South Wales especially, it's
really hard. And, you know, for a long time I've had a dream of starting a studio, and I've been, you know, quite intentionally making choices in my career to try and get the experience I felt like I needed to do it responsibly. So I see a lot of people dive straight into making a studio, like straight out of university or whatever, which I think is very brave and very cool.
Incredibly brave.
You know, but I also have worked at a lot of studios that were started by people who maybe weren't ready. And I know that it's a huge responsibility, because there is the part of you that's an artist that just wants to, like, you know, and it's so egomaniacal. It's like, I just want to like make my thing and put it out into the world and like influence the world with my art. And that in itself is beautiful and special. But starting a studio is also starting a business and starting a company that people's livelihoods depend upon, and like you have a really big impact on people's mental health and like the way that they engage with art making as well. And so I wanted to make sure that I was ready to do that properly and feel like I knew at least like enough to not massively ruin anyone's life with starting a company. I don't feel like I'm there, but you know, unfortunately, the time that it took for me to be ready really coincided with like massive economic downturn globally.
Crazy how that happened.
We love a recession to start right when you're ready to start a company.
I'm ready. Unfortunately, the world is not maybe.
Not ready for us. And it's also hard, I think. You know, I've certainly done a lot of pitches to rooms of people who don't fully understand that, you know, there is an audience for this kind of game. There is an audience for a game about women that isn't just about a woman being like a perfect military politician, you know, and that or isn't just like a miserable traumatic story about the life of being a woman, like that you can tell a joyful story about girlhood that is playful and fun and where people are not perfect characters, and that still has like systematic depth and like gameplay depth and nuance to it, and that people want those kind of games. I really believe that people want those kind of games, but you know, it's not easy getting money for that.
Oh yeah, and I think there's this weird kind of idea in the industry where it's like, oh, there's an audience for this, but there's not an audience for that. When realistically, it's kind of an audience for everything.
Mm-hmm.
There are just so many people. Like,
that is so true.
There's just so many people.
Have you ever thought about how many people there are?
There are just so many people in the world that like different things.
Yeah.
And like, even if you think it's the most niche idea, there's a good chance there's going to be quite a number of people who are into it. I think you can kind of look at the same thing with like content creation, for example, with YouTube. Like someone mm-hmm. will make a 3-hour long video
mm-hmm.
on an adult animation that you've never heard of that had one season and then it was cancelled, and it was kind of one of the best things ever made, but not many people had ever heard of it. And that gets hundreds of thousands, if not millions of views, because there is an interest in the niche, you know?
And I think even more now games. More than ever, like, it is almost impossible, like, unless you have a deranged amount of money, unless you're making the Barbie movie,
yeah.
to reach everyone.
Mm.
And so instead going in the opposite direction, but going more specific, going for a very targeted audience, I think is actually a cleaner path to success. I think if my studio started and tried to make a game that appealed to everyone, I think we'd be setting ourselves up for failure.
Yeah. And have you found the industry in terms of like other studios, other people working on games to be receptive to the game as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've always thought of the like independent development community to be very supportive, and certainly mm-hmm. it's a place where like I really found a sense of community in my life, like in my early career, and some of my closest friends I met through that space. And but even knowing everything that I knew, I've still been really shocked and overwhelmed by the support that the community has shown for us in starting a studio and making mistakes, and complete strangers, like people that I've never met before who know nothing about me, who are willing to spend their time like reviewing our pitch decks and giving us feedback or giving us insight into like recent conversations that they've had with funding partners and stuff, because it seems like genuinely we all want each other to succeed. And that is a really beautiful, affirming, like heartwarming experience to have. Sorry to be so earnest.
No, I think being earnest is awesome. I had like a moment the other day where I'm like, no, being sincere is very fucking cool. Being earnest and sincere is awesome. Being kind is awesome. Being a nice person is very pog. Like it's speaking your truth and being honest about how nice it is when something is the way it is, I think it's great. I think being earnest rocks. So
you
don't
be
sorry.
Here.
Don't be sorry. It rocks. Being earnest is just as cool as being super ironic and you know, saying something stupid. I think it's all good. It's fine. It rocks, in fact.
Thank you, Ruby.
And that's awesome, you know? And I feel like there is such, from what I've seen with the independent games industry in Australia, I feel like because we went through, I say we, I'm on the outside looking in, you know?
But I consider you to be one of us.
I come from a perspective of doing a lot of research and also spending time with a lot of developers and stuff, and looking at kind of the history of game development in Australia. And like there was that period of like, oh fuck, there's no more money going into this yeah. industry. Everybody is leaving. And there was this moment of panic, and like few studios survived. Like you had Wargaming Sydney, they mm-hmm. survived, and like great for them. That was awesome. And now they're riot. Like, that's an interesting thing that happened. But like, they were one of the very few studios to still kick it. And it's because
before,
like,
they were Wargaming, they were Big World.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, they just they evolved, mm-hmm. right? And evolving was one of the few ways that your studio kind of could survive during mm-hmm. that time in what, like the 2010s?
Yeah, and during the GFC.
Exactly. And so in these past few years, it's kind of all coming back, you know, like the government is putting more funding into the video games industry, but as well, while from, you know, all accounts, working on video games in Australia still is hard,
mm-hmm.
there seems to be a lot more hope.
Yeah, and I think it's hopeful. It is a bit scary as yeah. well, because obviously, like, the Australian dollar is not great right now. And so that means that, you know, we do draw attention from international investors who see us as like an affordable option, which is not really sustainable, because the dollar won't stay this low forever. And that's kind of exactly what happened with the GFC, is that we got a lot of overseas investment, and then when it wasn't so cheap anymore, it all went away. And all
they're
those,
like, hold on.
Wait a second.
I gotta go.
Why are we all flying all the way to Australia all
that's
the time?
That's really far away when I think about it.
That
so
sucks, actually.
We will no longer make Bioshock here.
Oh, it's so sad.
It's fucked. But
so it is kind of scary when you see stuff like that happen. I do think that, like, we're lucky in a way that there are still really key influences within our industry who were here during the GFC and went through that and can kind of be our sages and, like, tell us about
yeah.
what went wrong and the sort of what to avoid. I do think that we have become more cognizant of, you know, deals like that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there are some studios that are doing really exciting work, you know, that isn't necessarily, like, dependent on federal government funding.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a studio like Lumi making Kind of World, who have done their own, you know, investment round and raised a huge amount of money and are doing very, very well. Studios like that are incredible.
From how I see it, at least, I think a lot of the hope as well comes from each other. And mm-hmm. I know that sounds so cheesy, but, like, the independent industry in Australia is just so supportive of one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because we can't, like, it's kind of like the little guys, right? Like Australia, the Australian games industry has kind of had to build itself back up, and mm-hmm. it's a grassroots movement. Like, it's people, it's quote unquote little people all working together to get their games out of the door
yeah.
and make shit happen. And the hope of the industry doing better and better comes from the grassroots movement of all these video game developers making their own shit. Mm-hmm. Because it's all they can really do.
That's right. And, like, you know, we were joking earlier about how no one would get into games on purpose. But I do think that, like, a lot of people do accidentally end up in this space, but you only stay on purpose because you have to constantly make the choice to refuse to leave, you know, despite many obstacles and many other options. You know, there's lots of other careers that you can take out of games.
Yeah.
But the people who stay, I think, are here because they really want to be here and they have something to do, they have something to say, and they have something that they want to make. And I think it would surprise people, I think, how there is absolutely no sense of competition between developers and between studios. I have never had the experience, and I have approached basically every game developer in the country. I've never had the experience of someone being unwilling to share information, being unwilling to talk about their experience, being unwilling to, like, play test your game and give you feedback. I've literally never had anybody say no.
Yeah.
It's just and I think that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. It rocks. Well, I think we've been chatting for just the right amount of time. Oh, you thought I was going to say too long? No, perfect amount of time, actually.
No, I thought you'd say it was perfect because I'm perfect. And
because
it's all great.
This is a perfect episode of a podcast.
We're just two perfect
girls. Two perfect girls who have zero flaws and are sufferable.
That's
not
so
insufferable.
True.
We're so sufferable.
I've always said that about us.
Yeah, I've always said that about us too. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. How can people learn more about Mystiques?
You can follow us on twitter.com.
That's definitely what it's still called.
That's what it is to me. Mystique's Game. We're also on TikTok and Instagram if you want to check us out. Like I said, like, we are early in development, so everything that we share is very like sneak peek. What do you think of this? And if you're into that kind of thing, then definitely like come along for the journey.
And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing, why not give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using? Better yet, why not give us a nice little review? This one comes from Bibi Boy, and it says, if you see a podcast with Ruby listed as the host, you're going to have a good time. She's a sensational talent and does a brilliant job of holding engaging conversations about video games. Plus, the Back Pocket crew always brings the goods with good quality production value, even if Ruby and Gus don't like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom's minimalism. But thank you so much, Bibi Boy. Much, much love. And hey, if you really like what you're hearing and you'd like to hear more, consider supporting Back Pocket over on Patreon, where you can get access to our lovely Discord for all sorts of buds. If you support us at a certain tier, you can get access to even more audio content just like this. Bonus content, baby. You can also find us on Twitch, where we've got our main live show every Thursday from 7 p.m. AEST, and on TikTok, where we're constantly posting very good stuff for you to cast your big beautiful eyes on. And then there's the socials, which you can always get around as well. There's X, the Threads, whatever. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in. And as a funny little ghost inside a old vase would say, bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.